You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Last week, India's Chandrayaan-3 mission landed a spacecraft on the southern pole of the moon. Here's the reaction in their control room the moment the lander touched down.
जी हाँ, आप अपने स्क्रीन पे देख सकते हैं कि हम लैंडर मॉड्यूल
It's the newest major development in modern space exploration at a time when a mix of government-run and private space programs are aiming for the moon and beyond. The successful landing came just days after a Russian lander crashed in an attempt to do the same thing. Our next guest has been following the latest developments in the international space race, the significance of India's success, and what it all means for the future of space exploration. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you excited about space exploration? Do you want to see more American space missions? How about bringing people back to the moon? And what questions do you have for our expert on the space industry? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Eric Berger is the senior space editor at Ars Technica. Eric, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks very much. Good to talk to you again.
Let's start with this new successful landing from India. How big a deal was this for, I guess, another more recent entry into the quest to land things on places that aren't Earth?
For India, it was a huge deal. You know, they had tried to do this 3 years earlier with a Chandrayaan-2 mission, and they failed because they had some computer issues and that spacecraft crashed into the lunar surface. And so this was their second attempt, and the country had put a lot on this. The leader of the nation, Narendra Modi, has really played up sort of the space ambitions of India and as a point of national pride. And so there was a lot riding on the landing attempt this week. And the other matter is, you know, in Asia, India really sees itself as a competitor with China, and China's spacecraft program is pretty far ahead. They've had several successful lunar landings and actually returned some rocks from the moon a couple of years ago robotically. And so it was really important for India's national pride, I think, for this mission to be a success.
Yeah, I use the phrase space race, and I try to throw little air quotes around it. I mean, are we in a competitive environment where countries and or private industry are trying to hit that next milestone before whoever they perceive their competitors to be?
You know, it's really complicated, but it is accurate, I think, to say we're in a sort of a second generation space race. It's very different from the 1960s when it was just the United States and Soviet Union sort of, you know, marching out into the heavens. Now there are a mix of national players, and it's not just the U.S. and Russia. It's China, India, Europe, Japan, lots of different players. And then you've got commercial companies, you know, like SpaceX and Blue Origin and places like that, that are all really playing in this area and doing interesting things as well. And so there's lots of activity out there.
Now, this is the south pole of the moon. I want to talk about why this seems to be so interesting scientifically, technologically. Why is this part of the moon getting so much attention these days?
Well, it really goes back about 10 or 15 years ago when NASA crashed a probe into the south pole of the moon to basically see if in these permanently shadowed craters there was water ice. And they produced some not definitive but pretty convincing evidence that yes, there is. So these areas of the moon that never see the sun, and so over, you know, billions of years, ice has accumulated there. So there's believed to be legitimately water on the moon. And if you could get water on the moon, that's a pretty handy resource to have. And so you've got all of this activity, particularly from the United States and China, of over the next 5 to 10 years of sending probes to the south pole of the moon, investigating these permanently shadowed regions and seeing if there is really ice there to mine and to be had. And once you have ice, of course, you've got hydrogen fuel, you've got oxygen oxidizer, you can also breathe it, you can also drink the water, make it potable. So it's a pretty handy resource to have in place there. And so, you know, the Indian probe didn't quite make it to the South Pole. It was about 70 degrees south, so about kind of the northern edge of Sweden, in reference to the North Pole here on Earth. But it is certainly the closest that any probe has gotten so far to the South Pole.
And I read somewhere, I think, that Eric, the South Pole itself is a tough place to land a probe. It's rough ground. It is a challenge to get something much closer to the pole. Is that right?
Yeah, both from an energy standpoint, in terms of trying to get a spacecraft there, it is easier to go to these equatorial regions that we saw the Apollo missions go to and some of these other spacecraft. And the South Pole and the North Pole, for that matter, are a little bit more difficult, as you say, because the lighting conditions are difficult, a little more challenging to work with, and the terrain appears to be a little bit more uneven, especially you don't really want to land on the edge of a crater, right? You'd mm-hmm. much rather have these smoother, flatter areas.
Talking to Eric Berger, senior space editor at Ars Technica, looking at the latest news from space, efforts to land probes on the moon, one from India successful, one from Russia not, and we'll look at what's going on in the United States as well. You could join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question for our guest. Do you have a goal in mind that you'd like to see? Private companies, governments, whatever aiming for, join in at 800-642-1234. Eric, you wrote a piece about the Russian space program, the crash of their latest probe and a decline. You know, they inherited the Soviet era space program, one of the only two games in town for a long time. What has gone wrong there as you see it?
Well, you know, the Soviets had a very inventive and extraordinary space program in the 1960s and 70s. And then with the collapse of the Soviet Union, you know, they really stopped innovating and putting substantial funding in. So they're basically flying the same vehicles that were developed in the 1960s and 70s. They're very good, right, at what they do for human spaceflight, but they're not modern in any sense of the word. And the fact of the matter is, you know, since the 1970s, the Russians have not sent any probe into deep space successfully. They've had some failed Mars missions, and then just earlier this summer, they attempted to land on the moon with the Luna 25 probe, and they were unsuccessful at crashing into the moon, which really provided, I think, a striking contrast. India comes along a couple of weeks later and successfully lands on the moon, kind of saying that, you know, India can now do something in space pretty significant that Russia has lost the capability to do.
Let's talk about international cooperation. I mean, Russia had up till, I think, fairly recently been able to cooperate with Western Europe and with the United States. That seems to have run into trouble, especially with the invasion of Ukraine. Who is and who isn't going in alone? Who's playing well with others to try to combine efforts?
Yeah, so the Russian space program had pretty deep ties, not just with NASA and the International Space Station, but certainly with the European space industry. Europe launched a lot of their Soyuz rockets from Europe's own spaceport, and then they also had this joint mission to go to Mars, where Russia was basically building a lander on a spacecraft that was built by Europe that was going to go to Mars, and so they were going to have an opportunity to have a successful mission to Mars. A lot of that cooperation broke down, and so now it's just basically a bare bones cooperation between NASA and Russia and Europe on the International Space Station and nothing else. And all of that is due to the war in Ukraine. It was really the European Space Agency backed away very quickly. And so now, you know, if we step back and look at the moon, you have two kind of competing efforts to send humans to the moon. You've got NASA with its Artemis program, and then the Europeans, many of the European countries are going along with that, and other countries around the world. And then you have China and its effort to go to the moon by 2030 or the mid-2030s. And actually Russia has signed on to the Chinese effort. And so that cooperation has kind of shifted, especially in light of the Ukraine war.
Now, there's been arguments about, you know, should putting people back on the moon be a goal? How much of this, whether it's China or the U.S. and allies, is it, yeah, there's going to be genuine scientific value to putting people on the moon versus the symbolic milestone of it?
So, you know, it was all about geopolitics back in the 1960s. It was basically, is capitalism supreme or is communism supreme? And there's definitely a major geopolitical element of this current race between the United States and China. I think both nations see, you know, leading these international coalitions is very important. But the things have changed, right? And probably the biggest change, certainly for the United States, has been the rise of the commercial space industry. So it's not just about, you know, putting flags and footprints on the moon. It's really trying to lay down the ground for a sustainable operation, so long-term operation. So not just going there a few times and stopping, but actually going there and staying there and ultimately harvesting resources on the moon and potentially asteroids as well. And so there are private companies like SpaceX, Blue Origin, and other companies that are playing an important role as part of NASA's program. And the thought is that if NASA goes first, then it will sort of pave the way for commercial activity to follow, much like the Transcontinental Railroad sort of did in the United States, you know, 150 or 200 years ago, to kind of open up the West to settlers and commercial activity. That's a very broad metaphor. I don't know if that's what's going to happen, but that's kind of big picture the goal.
We're talking to Eric Berger, senior space editor at Ars Technica, looking at recent developments in space exploration, including the latest efforts to land probes on the south pole of the moon. Coming up, we'll look more at the private companies here in the U.S. getting in the game, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. If you lived through the Cold War era space race, what do you remember about that time? Did you watch the moon landing back in 1969? What are you thinking now as you watch the newest kind of space race? What should the priorities be, if any? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions, or you can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Eric Berger, senior space editor at Ars Technica. We're talking to him about the latest from space, including India's successful Chandrayaan-3 mission to the South Pole or near the South Pole of the moon and the state of the broader space industry. We're going to check out the latest from private companies. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest? Do you want the United States to prioritize getting into space, maybe getting people on the moon, more probes to Mars? What, if anything, do you want to see as priority number one? If commercial space flight, orbital flight, whatever, got inexpensive enough, would you go? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Eric, I want to talk about the newest rounds of private companies getting into the space industry. Now, there's always been some level of public-private partnership going on here. Companies like Northrop, I think, and Boeing and whatever, designing our older spacecraft. What companies are at the top of your list right now with the most promising developments?
Well, I think you would have to put SpaceX at the top of the list in terms of accomplishments. You know, they're the ones that they're up to launch as many as 100 rockets this year. They're going to send 3/4 of all mass sent to space this year will be launched by a single company. That's not like the United States, that's just SpaceX. And that you add up all the rest of the countries in the US and Europe and China and India. And so they're the ones doing the most interesting things. But there's a lot of other commercial activity behind SpaceX coming along as well. And so it's, you know, what NASA has really done over the last 15 or 20 years is stimulate this vibrant commercial space industry, which is really kind of giving this country its edge as it looks out in the 2020s and 2030s and wants to compete with China in space.
What are some of the companies on the list, maybe far behind SpaceX, but trying to emerge?
And you've got companies doing all sorts of different things. Like there's a company called Astroscale, which is trying to build satellites and spacecraft that can go out and take care of space junk in low Earth orbit, because there's a lot of old derelict satellites and pieces of rockets and debris up there that we could try to clean up that orbit. You've got a company like OrbitFab, which wants to build refineries in space, and so they could take water launched from Earth or collected on the moon and produce hydrogen peroxide or other things that other companies and customers might want. Blue Origin, the company owned by Jeff Bezos, is trying to build a completely reusable transportation system between the Earth and the moon that would refuel with liquid hydrogen. And so there's just lots of innovative ideas happening. It's kind of a wild, wild west in terms of financing. You know, a lot of these space companies went public over the last couple of years with this special purpose acquisition company or SPACs. And they've not performed financially very well, so the stocks have taken a beating. And so, you know, it's sort of we're at a tipping point moment where we may see this industry really explode or it may take a step back.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Rod is with us in La Crosse. Rod, hi.
Yes, hello. I just wondered, once they sit there and get up there and they get on the moon and do they all start grabbing land like they did in America from the Native Americans? That I mean, they say, well, this is my part, and then they said go to Mars and sit there and start grabbing land there too. I mean, this country has been so greedy anyhow, the way it's been, no matter who you are, you know, humans are the worst people on the planet. I mean, animals sit there and they're far better than humans.
Rod, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call. Now, as I understand it, Eric, there is a treaty, an agreement that no one country will start marking off territory, claim to parts of the moon's surface. Is there a thought that once we actually start going there, we'll observe that?
So that's a great question. You know, I think it probably is going to work somewhat like it does in Antarctica, where countries can have outposts and bases, but no one owns any of the land in Antarctica. But that is certainly going to be a territorial dispute or potentially an issue at the South Pole, which is, you know, we're talking about tens to maybe hundreds of miles of sort of land, not a huge area. Sort of at the South Pole that's really of interest, where these permanently shadowed regions are in the craters. So that is potentially something that could be disputed. And then also the commercial companies, you know, we're trying to get some assurances from the United States that, hey, you know, if I went to the moon and spent all of this money harvesting these resources, can I really resell those resources? Because, you know, they're not going to own the territory that they're on either. So the Outer Space Treaty is now 50 years old. It nominally sets up the rules of the law, which says no one can own this land, but it kind of may be the sort of thing where, you know, possession is 9/10 of the law once people get there. It's something really to watch over the next 5 to 10 years. The caller raises a great point.
Rod, thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Eric, you mentioned earlier the Artemis mission, the goal over the next few years to work back to landing people on the moon, led by the U.S. with a bunch of partners. Along with that is this diplomatic effort called the Artemis Accords. As you mentioned, European countries, I think I saw Saudi Arabia, Rwanda, South Korea, Japan, others, India signed onto it, not Russia and China, but it sets out all these pretty ambitious goals on cooperation and sharing all the science and not claiming land. Is this just, you know, diplomatic paperwork, or is there something really there to these Artemis Accords?
I think there's something really there. You know, about 30 countries have signed on, and these basically set the rules of the road by which NASA and its partners are going to explore the moon. And so that means like the sharing of scientific data, you know, just kind of transparency, you know, operating out in the open, that kind of thing. It's a pretty benevolent way of exploration. It says, hey, we're going to do this, and we think these are the best practices, you know, for exploring the moon in the 21st century, and we'd like you to come along. And so you've got, like I said, you've got the Artemis Accords and the nations that are sort of signed up for that. And the incentive there, of course, is if you give some money, then potentially you could have an astronaut on the surface of the moon in 10 or 15 years. And so we're likely to see that. We've already seen that with China, you know, or excuse me, with Canada. There will be an astronaut flying around the moon on the Artemis II mission in just a couple of years. And in the future, we're going to see European and Japanese astronauts on the surface of the moon. And then, as you said, China and Russia are, and some other countries that have signed up with them, like Venezuela, are going to go their own way.
Talking to Eric Berger, senior space editor at Ars Technica, looking at the latest news in space exploration. Eric, you mentioned, you know, we've got these private companies in the U.S., but a lot of them driven by NASA and federal government funding incentives. I know over the years there have been arguments, you know, where do we direct our money? Moon, Mars, people, unmanned probes, telescopes, satellites, whatever. What do you see as the latest priorities coming out of NASA that are driving some of this?
So it's really interesting. If you look at public survey after public survey, the top two priorities you get from the public are protecting the Earth from asteroids. So like, you know, being able to deflect a killer asteroid and finding them before they can hit Earth. And the other one is Earth science, understanding and studying our planet. And actually, if you look down the list, you have to go pretty far down before you find human exploration of the moon and Mars. But, you know, NASA is doing some things, a lot of things for Earth science, and is doing some things for planetary science, but the majority of its budget is spent on human exploration. And there for a long time, there was a debate about, well, should we go back to the moon or should we go straight to Mars? And I think what we've really seen with this Artemis program, and what I like as someone who's followed the space industry for a long time, is that it does have a pretty coherent plan. It says, look, we're going to go back to the moon. It's something we can achieve within the next 5 to 10 years. And we're going to learn how to live there and work there and get the tools and strategies we need eventually to have a program to go on to Mars. And so I think the Artemis program is pretty good in concept. But we're certainly spending a lot of money on it, and as opposed to Earth science and asteroid defense.
I want to visit Mars for a moment. We've got rovers, Eric, that seem to keep outlasting their expected lifespan. I think I read a piece you wrote about the helicopter on Mars that was supposed to do 5 missions. It's done dozens, and it recovered from an unplanned landing. What do we have on the surface of Mars that you're watching right now?
Well, we've got 2 rovers, Perseverance and Curiosity. Curiosity has been there about a decade, and Perseverance for several years less. And then the helicopter has been flying along with Perseverance. Got a couple orbiters flying around the planet. And then, you know, there's China has a rover on Mars. It's active as well. And, you know, NASA's working on a mission to go to Mars and return some samples from there to study in Earth laboratories. So there's a lot going on Mars scientifically, but there is the stated goal by NASA and private companies like Elon Musk and SpaceX to send humans to Mars, you know, within the next 15 to 20 years. I'm not convinced that's feasible, but that's certainly something they're working toward.
And do you have your eyes elsewhere in the solar system? I think we mostly talk about, well, the Earth, of course, the moon and Mars. What else is going on in our neighborhood?
So there's some really exciting missions that are coming up. Next year, NASA is going to launch a probe to the Jupiter's moon Europa, which is entirely covered in ice. But it's believed to be, there's believed to be a huge ocean underneath the ice on Europa. There's more water on Europa than it exists on all the oceans here on Earth. And so that probe is going to go and fly by Europa more than 2 dozen times later this decade and return some fantastic data. And then there's another mission. It's going to Titan, which is a moon around Saturn, which has on its surface seas of liquid methane. Fascinating place. And we're going to go there and actually fly a helicopter-like object called Dragonfly around and get all kinds of information about the moons. And so the moons of Jupiter and Saturn are quite fascinating. We're finally starting to send dedicated probes there, and that's something I'm very excited about.
Eric, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
That's Eric Berger, senior space editor at Ars Technica. He was with us to talk about recent developments in space exploration, including India's recent successful landing near the South Pole of the Moon. You can follow Eric's reporting, a lot of great information, up-to-date information on the latest rocket technology as well, at arstechnica.com. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, get a preview of the Wisconsin Badger football season just in time for the opening game coming up this weekend. If you have questions, things you're going to be watching for or wondering about in this new season, get the conversation started now. Email ideas@WPR.org. Then join the show tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Net. If you're like me, you'll probably never walk on the moon. But good news, tonight you can get a closer than usual look at it. It's the second supermoon of the month tonight, and it's a good one. NASA says a supermoon happens when a full moon corresponds to the moon's orbit being at its closest point to Earth. It's supposed to look big, bright, and cool, and we should get a great view in Wisconsin. Took a quick look at the weather, clear to mostly clear skies all over the state tonight. Start watching for moonrise after 7:30 tonight. The full moon technically is, I guess, at 8:36 p.m. As NPR reports, the moon's going to look around 8% larger and 50% brighter than a normal full moon. If you miss it tonight, it'll still be big and full for a couple more nights. By the way, you might be able to see Saturn up near the moon tonight. Lunar exploration from the comforts of home. This is Central Time. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferrin. Coming up, it's back to school time, and we're going behind the scenes on school lunches and the people, politics, and policies behind them. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about being seen.
What's one of the best ways to combat hate? For Jesus Gregorio Smith of Appleton, it's to push back with love. He shares his story as part of the Home Is Here project, which amplifies the voices of the growing number of Black, Asian, Native American, and Latino residents who call northeastern Wisconsin home.
I saw the sign up on Richmond Street in downtown Appleton, and I couldn't believe my eyes. It was just a sign flashing the F word, the one that rhymes with maggots. It was displayed across a business sign so everyone driving down the road could see it like it was nothing. All I could think about was how could this be possible? Those poor queer kids who already have a hard time with family, within themselves being gay or bi or trans, what happens when they see this sign spewing so much hate? I had to do something. I've experienced my fair share of hatred and bigotry throughout my life. I was born and raised in the little old town of El Paso, Texas. My father, Johnny Smith, is an African-American man who was born in the 1940s during legal segregation. While Dad was stationed at Fort Bliss, he traveled to Juarez, Mexico with his fellow soldiers for drinks and fun nights. It's there he fell in love with my mother, Sonia Smith. Once they were married, they had 5 mixed-race children. I'm the youngest of the 5. I had the luxury and honor of having 2 cultural backgrounds and influences in my life. But that luxury also had costs. I recall the first time I was ever called the N-word, and it was by Mexican folks. And I thought to myself, don't we all have it bad enough? Why are we picking on each other? I'll never forget the time my mother gave me this serious talk in first grade because she was embarrassed with how feminine I was as a child. In fact, the first person to ever call me the F-word was my mother. My father instilled a particular vision of black masculinity that was meant to protect my brothers and I in the world. He stressed that I needed to get a good job in computers in order to be successful. As I got older, I hid my gayness and only pursued paths that would make my family proud, keep me hidden, and keep the comments about me to a minimum. But college didn't lead to a career in computers. Instead, I faced my fears and embraced my identity. I began empowering fellow members of the queer LGBTQIA community. Eventually, I got my PhD in sociology with a focus on race, sexuality, and masculinity. And that's what brought me to Wisconsin, a job at Appleton's Lawrence University as an assistant professor of ethnic studies. Which brings me back to that homophobic sign I saw in downtown Appleton. I didn't let the hate deter me. So when I decided to protest under the sign, I gayed it up even more to be exactly what the sign said I was. I put on a purple wig, a rainbow shirt, white high heels, and danced around to Born This Way by Lady Gaga. I filmed a silly video and took a photo. The photo went viral on social media. Not too long after, numerous Appleton residents showed up to fight against the hate, resulting in it coming down. I took that viral image, put it on a shirt and sold it, and raised $15,000 for the Sexual Assault Crisis Center. That is how you turn that hate into love. Through the process of finding oneself, embracing oneself, and living as one's authentic self, one can counter painful experiences and turn them into something different. I tried to hide myself from pain, but when I bravely faced it, I overcame it. It isn't easy, but I think we deserve to see a different world. Determining your own path, despite what others say, can help you break out of molds that confine you. I eventually embraced who I was and made a huge difference in people's lives, as well as my own.
Jesus Gregorio Smith is an associate professor of ethnic studies at Lawrence University. His story is part of the Home Is Here project from the New News Lab, a local news collaboration in northeastern Wisconsin made of 6 media organizations, including WPR and the Green Bay Press-Gazette. More information can be found at wisconsinlife.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCullum.
Now, kids are headed back to school in Wisconsin in the coming weeks if they're not back already. And we're paying a visit now to an often overlooked part of the school experience, the cafeteria. What's served in schools in Wisconsin, where it comes from, why access to good nutrition is not always equal, the workforce behind school lunches, and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you grow up eating school lunches? What differences do you see from when you were growing up and what your kids might see today? Do your kids eat school lunches or bring their own to school? Have you ever worked in the school cafeteria? Love to hear about your experience. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Jennifer Gaddis is an associate professor of civil society and community studies at UW-Madison, and she sits on the advisory board of the National Farm to School Network. She's the author of the book, The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. Jennifer, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
We've talked in the past, Jennifer, a little bit about kind of an unplanned experiment with school lunches that came about because of the pandemic. What kind of things have changed? What kind of things do you think we've learned from the pandemic era and how we changed our school lunch programs?
Yeah, I think that one thing that was really huge during the pandemic era is that we had this really wonderful experiment nationwide where we were able to offer free school breakfasts and lunches to all children, regardless of their household income. And that's something that from the very, very beginning of school lunch programs in the United States, dating back over 100 years, had been a dream of a lot of the people who created these programs. And the pandemic is something that really made it both politically and logistically possible for about 2 years. Since then, basically starting the last school year, families across Wisconsin, for the most part, have experienced a return to the pre-pandemic model where students pay for school lunch based on their family income. So for example, a family of four earning $39,000 or less in Wisconsin would qualify for free meals. Those in a family of four earning between $39,001 and $55,500 would qualify for reduced price meals, which cost 40 cents for lunch. But everyone else would fall into this paid category where the local school district or private school that's participating in the National School Breakfast and Lunch Program sets the particular prices at the local level. So we've kind of gone back to that old model in most all schools across the state of Wisconsin. But there's a lot of momentum nationwide to get the old model from the pandemic of free school meals for all back. In fact, eight states, including a few of our neighbors, Minnesota and Michigan, and actually Illinois is poised to be the ninth state, have passed state-level legislation that will guarantee students free school breakfasts and lunches into the future. So I think that it's something that has really sparked a national conversation and movement about why is it that school meals seem to be the only thing in schools that we actually treat as something that parents and caregivers should be paying for separately and differently based on their economic station. You know, you don't do that for bus rides, you don't do that for gym class, for English, for math. So it's sort of a weird exception. And I think that there's this growing movement now to really see school meals and nutrition as a necessary material resource for all students to really excel academically and just thrive in terms of mental and emotional and physical well-being. So I think it's kind of opened up a new conversation about what school meals are for and how they should be funded.
And you are working, I understand, on a study about how parents and caregivers feel about school lunches, because finances aren't the only factor. In some cases, you know, parents, even with free school lunch, don't go with it. What kind of things are you hoping to find out?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I'm glad you brought that up. So in some of the states that have begun to offer free school meals for all, and even in some of the districts in Wisconsin that offer free school meals for all through something called the community eligibility provision, we sometimes see that participation rates, you know, hover around 60 to 70%. And so it kind of begs this question of what else is going on. And on the one hand, I think that there are some issues with people maybe having misperceptions about meal quality. So I think, for example, I went to school in the 1990s. School meals are very different today than what they looked like when I was a kid. A lot of research studies actually show that school meals are the healthiest food that students actually consume. And even healthier on average than what parents or caregivers might be packing as part of a home lunch. So I think that there are some misperceptions about the nutritional quality of school meals. And I think also in some schools where they're not doing a lot of fresh preparation, which we often refer to as scratch cooking, I think that there's some concerns about food quality as well. And some of those things I think you know, can vary from school to school or even district to district in terms of, you know, how much the perception really matches reality. I think that there are a lot of places across the state of Wisconsin and nationally that have been doing really phenomenal work trying to transition to more scratch cooking and doing a lot of what we call farm to school, which means sourcing more food from local Wisconsin farmers and other producers, and also providing more educational opportunities for students around the food. So I think that there's a lot of things that have changed that parents might not be necessarily aware of, but I think that there's also still some struggles. So for example, you know, thinking about an elementary student, if they see that, for example, it's supposed to be grilled cheese and tomato soup on a particular day, and then the school has to do some sort of menu substitution, and then the child arrives and, you know, what they decided they were going to eat for lunch that day isn't on offer, and it's something that they don't like or don't feel comfortable eating. And so then they maybe decide not to eat school lunch that day. And then they come home, they tell their parent or their caregiver, you know, that they went hungry that day. That can be something that would make a parent feel, you know, guilty or worried or concerned that their child isn't necessarily being taken care of. So I think that there's definitely some issues in terms of just, you know, people really wanting the best for their kids and a lot of trust that goes into really letting somebody else take on that role of feeding your child. But I will say from my experience in school cafeterias across the state and really getting to know a lot of the really wonderful people who work in school nutrition programs, that they really, really care about the kids. And I think that the workers across the state would love nothing more than to be able to feed all students across the state free of charge and to have the resources that they need to produce fresh meals that students are really happy to eat and that parents feel really excited about their kids eating.
We're talking about school lunch and back to school season. Our guest is Jennifer Gaddis. She's from UW-Madison and author of the book, The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. Coming up, we'll look at who's making and serving these lunches, the conditions they work in, what they get paid. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever worked in a school cafeteria, maybe as a nutritionist, a cook, a part-time worker? Are you doing it? Are you gearing up to do it right now? Love to hear what you've experienced there, what you think maybe should change, what you wish people knew about that job. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with UW-Madison professor Jennifer Gaddis, author of the book, The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. We're talking about school lunches and school cafeterias in the back-to-school season. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about policies, the projects that go into school lunches? Do you want to share your experience as a parent, a student, somebody working to provide these lunches, or maybe a farmer supplying schools? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Jennifer, let's talk about who is making these lunches. You've done a lot of research, including some out earlier this year, on things like pay for school lunch workers, school cafeteria workers. What kind of things did you find out?
Yeah, so we did a study that included about 25% of schools across the state of Wisconsin. And what we found out was that part-time workers make up the backbone of school nutrition programs across the state. 4 out of 5 non-managerial employees work part-time hours. And most of those jobs are what we would consider to be poverty wage or low wage jobs. But there has been some increase in terms of what wages look like, particularly in this last kind of 2 years as schools have been transitioning back to in-person schooling and to this new real competitive you know, marketplace for different kinds of employees. But we have definitely found that there's a pretty significant wage gap between people who work in cafeterias and kitchens in our elementary and secondary schools versus, for example, retirement and assisted living or medical facilities such as hospitals, even though a lot of the work is actually quite similar. And I think one thing people don't necessarily understand about school nutrition workers is that they're not only preparing and serving food, but they also have to understand a lot of different regulations coming not only from the federal government, but also from state and also like from the county and even local district wellness policies. They have a lot of things that they have to kind of keep in their minds in terms of different paperwork and requirements. They have to be able to follow food safety protocols, accommodate special diets, and they also have at least 4 and up to 12 hours of continuing education that they have to do every year to satisfy the federal government's professional standards. So there's a lot that goes into the work that I think a lot of people don't necessarily realize. So part of the challenge, I think, is to help people understand that this is a profession that deserves respect and that people oftentimes are actually taking a pretty big hit to their annual take-home pay just because they really care about the kids that they're feeding and want to work in a school setting. Another thing that we found was that this is a very gendered workforce. So over 90% of the workers in school nutrition programs in the state of Wisconsin are women. And if we look, for example, at the difference in pay between school nutrition workers and custodial workers, who most often are men, there's a pretty significant difference in hourly pay. So I think for a variety of reasons, a number of school districts across the state are really trying to do what they can to increase workers' wages, because if school nutrition programs can't actually recruit and retain enough employees, that has a really big impact on the quality of the food and the quality of the experience for the students that they're serving.
And looking at that report, Jennifer, I want to key in on that turnover issue. That report, you talked to a lot of supervisors, they said, yeah, I lost 4 or 5 out of my 10 staff this year. This is a problem.
Yeah, and I think that school nutrition employees usually are the lowest paid or tied for lowest paid in a school system. So one thing that a number of the directors and managers that we spoke with for this report would say is that it almost seems as if people from other departments in the school are actually coming and poaching workers from my department to serve as like paraprofessionals, for example, or student aides. And so it can be really difficult for them to not only be competing with private sector jobs, but also to be actually retaining their employees even within the school system. So it's definitely something that I think is a big issue. And another thing that we found was that a lot of the workers in school nutrition programs on the money that they take home, they really can't even afford housing. So a lot of employees actually have 2 or even 3 jobs. And that's something that I think is really exacerbated by the fact that most schools have their employees in 9-month contracts. So it means that not only are you having part-time hours at low pay, but also you don't necessarily have guaranteed work during the summer. So it can be something that is very challenging in terms of school districts really being able to make sure that they have the staffing that they need. So that's one reason why in some of the states that have passed what's called Healthy School Meals for All legislation, they've actually included provisions to really direct additional money towards workers' wages and compensation, as well as workforce development, to make sure that people are trained to do fresh cooking and to use more local products.
Let's bring on a caller. Liz is with us in Lyons. Liz, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about, Liz?
So I worked in Georgia as an SNP for 5 years, and it was during the time that Michelle Obama had started the My Plate initiative with the fresh foods coming in. I liked it because it helped the farmers bring in more products to us, but it also, I worked in poverty level elementary and middle schools. We also had to teach classes to these children about what these fruits and vegetables are, how much you should eat, the My Plate situation and everything, because they had no idea. They had never seen certain fruits or vegetables before when we would put them out on the line. And so they wouldn't take them. So then we would have to turn around and do a class and teach them what it was, how much you should eat, and what, you know, what was good for them.
Liz, interesting perspective. Jennifer, in just our last minute or so, when we make a change in our nutrition programs, how to bring the kids themselves on board?
Well, I think that definitely that education piece is a big one, but also I think that giving the opportunity for students to have more input in designing menus is a really great strategy. So for example, in Madison, where I am at East High School last school year, one of the culinary classes actually worked with their teacher and with the school district to develop some new recipes that they taste tested with, you know, students in their high school. And then the recipes that were most popular were actually integrated into the regular school cycle menu. So I think that definitely the educational piece is important, but also really making these programs more participatory and giving students more voice, and certainly saying that things need to be healthy and to meet nutritional standards, but there's a lot of different forms of healthy food, right? And there's a lot of ways that students might be able to give input in terms of what they would really like to see. And for the most part, with the work that I've done in school districts across the state, we really hear the same thing time and time again, that students just want to have fresher, higher quality food. So there's certain things that I think are definitely popular in schools that we don't necessarily need to change, but it's more about making sure that the food is a little bit fresher when it's served, and that students do have access to things that are reflective of their cultures and what they're eating at home as well.
Liz, thanks for the call. And Jennifer, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That's Jennifer Gaddis, Associate Professor of Civil Society and Community Studies at UW-Madison. Jennifer sits on the advisory board of the National Farm to School Network, and she's the author of The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. She joined us for a behind-the-scenes look at school lunch programs. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, there's a lot of need for professional workers in senior care facilities. A project in Eau Claire is working to give people the training they need to do those jobs. We'll meet the organizers. That and more tomorrow on Central Time.